Artifact Uprising wants to help you preserve your meaningful moments this holiday season. Whether you want to say I love you with the perfect gift, display favorite memories in your home, or connect with loved ones throughout the year, they have a product you can personalize.
Yes, so many wonderful products, and that even includes baby board books, which is something that I recently personalized for my 2-year-old son, Leo, who loves to read. And I titled the book, A Boy Named Leo. And the best part is that it all comes illustrated with some of my favorite pictures of him by himself and with family and friends. It really is such a sweet, unique, and special commemoration of our life together thus far, and something we will all cherish forever.
Artifact Uprising makes it easy to tell your story. Through the end of the year, Dress listeners can give Artifact Uprising a try and get 20% off for new customers or 15% off if you have purchased before. Just visit artifactuprising.com and use the code DRESSED through December 31st.
During the summer, I love to keep Fiji water on hand to keep me and my family hydrated and refreshed. It really is sourced from the islands of Fiji. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable ancient aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements. As the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium water bottle brands, giving Fiji water its soft, smooth taste. Unlike some other premium bottled waters, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring, and this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water, and since 2022, its 330 milliliter and 500 milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic, so you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water. Get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office. It's not just water, it's Fiji water.
Dressed, the History of Fashion is a production of Dressed Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dressed, the History of Fashion. Podcast where we explore the who, what, when, and why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, April Callahan
and Cassidy Zachary. Dress listeners, welcome back to part two of our installment of Fashion History Terms A to Z. I am super interested to see what you have for Q, April.
Okay, well, this was a hard one. This was the most difficult one. Q and Y were really hard. So, quizzing glasses. Do you want to tell our listeners what quizzing glasses were? Again, we're going back to the dandies.
Yeah, no idea.
No. Okay. It's the culture of the Onquayabla, moving slightly forward from the Onquayablas, which was a subculture right after the French Revolution. And they were called Onquayabla, which is the French term for Incredibles, because what they wore was so insane that people just called them the Incredibles. So we've done a two-part episode on the Merveilleuses, and which was their feminine counterparts. The Marvelous Ones and the Incredibles. And you can tune back into those episodes. Those were early on, 2018, probably. But one of the features of Onquayabla fashion, and then a little bit later, was a quizzing glass. And essentially what this is, it's a monocle. We all know what a monocle is, right? That singular eyeglass. But it was attached to the end of a stick or a cane.
Yes.
And it was particularly used in the 1810s. In the 1820s. And you'll see it depicted in these fashion plates or illustrations of the Onquayabla. In the 1920s, generally speaking, they were squinting and scrunching their face and wearing it straight into the eye. But in the 1810s and the 1820s, gents had them on sticks. And to be perfectly honest, this was less about correcting one's vision.
I was going to say it's an affectation. It's part of their...
It's an affectation. It's performative disdain. We're cooler than you. We're going to inspect you from over here with our little monocle on our stick.
And also a reminder, too, that we've done a two-part episode. I think it was two parts on the history of the dude, which is, you know, an extension of the dandy, a cultural phenomenon of the late 19th century that is directly related to fashion before it became related to the Big Lebowski and a form of our slang speech.
You have also done, too, a really wonderful episode on Black dandyism as well.
Yes, in the past. With Dr. Monica L. Miller and her book Slaves to Fashion. So yeah, we've actually done, not necessarily recently, but we have done quite a few menswear episodes, actually. Okay.
Stump me.
I don't think I'm going to stump you. I started just having fun with fun terms, and I know you've heard of this term, but maybe our dress listeners have not within the context of fashion. Have you heard of a rat?
A rat? Yes, I definitely know what this is. So a rat is, it's also could be sometimes called a bumper, but it's essentially something that women wore in their hair to give it more volume underneath. So mm-hmm. it's like a false hairpiece.
Mm-hmm.
And this actually has a fascinating, very long history. Of course, if we go all the way back to the 18th century at the court of Marie Antoinette and women were wearing those insane poofs, there's always some sort of understructure creating that volume, right? Supporting it. But into the 19th century, also there's this whole side object curiosity of when women would brush their hair and you, when you pull your excess hair that gets caught up in your brush, they would put it into this little ceramic, oftentimes receptacle with a hole on their vanity and keep it so they could build their own rats with their own hair. So it wasn't a padding or gauze or anything. It was actually their own hair that they were then crafting into these little bumpers or rats.
So yeah, it's a pad made of human hair or wire or other stuffing over which the hair was combed. Popular in the 1860s, especially when women started wearing their hair rolled at the back and sides of their head. And something I found really fascinating is that this name, right? Is it related to the animal? Like, how did they come up with this name? And I couldn't actually get to the heart of that, but I did found it put into an interesting context of other of women's hairstyles of the period, thanks to Godey's Lady's Book in 1864. That's mentioning it within the context of other kind of bizarrely named hair accoutrements. And it says that rats are the long frisettes of curled hair for the side rolls. The mice are the smaller ones above them. The cat is for the roll laid over the top of the head. And the cataract is for the chignon at the back of the head, which is sometimes called waterfall, cataract, and jet d'eau. So apparently a game of cat, mouse, and rat all happening on top of ladies' heads at this time.
And a waterfall.
Exactly.
Wow. Yeah. So if you ever see those styles of the late 19th century and women look like they have a ton of hair, yes, they were absolutely growing their hair really long. So a lot of that is their own. But if you look at fashion magazines from that time period, there are so many ads for all of these hair pieces and also the buying and selling of human hair.
Yes. And this is actually foreshadowing next week's episodes, which are actually exclusively dedicated to 19th century hair dressing practices. So something to look forward to.
Amazing. I don't know about you, Cass, but I have not yet had lunch today, so I'm a tad hungry. So maybe I should put on my sandwich board jumper.
Sandwich board jumper.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on this?
No.
Okay. It is a jumper, aka sweater, apparently made by joining two oblong pieces of fabric at the shoulders and the waistline. And it's called this because it resembles a sign that was worn historically in the past by people advertising things where it would have a front and a back, mm-hmm. and they were called sandwich board signs. But essentially, it's a sweater that does that same effect. And the reason why I ended up picking this term for S was the fact that I realized I actually have one of these in my closet. And it dates to the early 1970s. So it's like this khaki sweater, and it comes, it's almost like a cape, but it doesn't have sides or arms at all. And it comes probably about 6 inches below my knee, and it has a turtleneck, and it just goes over the front and over the back. And then you can, if you choose to, attach the front and the back on the sides at the waist by these little knit, like matching, like,
yeah,
cincture belt pieces, or you can just wear it open. And I was like, oh, I have one of those.
Now I know. And I'm sure some of our listeners do too. Maybe they have several of these types of pieces in their wardrobes. And now you have another name for it.
Sandwich board jumper.
So my next term, again, having to do with the material culture of our day-to-day lives. And this is self-explanatory, but it's interesting in terms of its context of fashion, what a ticket pocket is.
I do know what that is. But you tell us.
It's pretty self-explanatory, right? It's a pocket for your ticket.
Something. It was a very short time period when these were ever made, really, right?
They start coming out in the 1850s. In men's fashion specifically, but also in kind of women's riding habits as well. Women who wore men's style suiting would have ticket pockets. And during a period when, especially in the latter half of the 19th century, when trains became really relevant and very common throughout Europe and the United States, you would need a place, a very special place where you would not lose your ticket, where you would keep your ticket. And they're very specific in where they're located, like the right flat pocket and various places. They're mentioned so many times in things like Harper's Bazaar, especially, which before it was exclusively a women's fashion magazine, was more of a societal magazine, as was Vogue, as many of our listeners know. And so you see a lot of references to men's fashion in Harper's Bazaar and reference to ticket pockets and this kind of new material culture that would have come into being in the latter half of the 19th century.
I've actually even seen them referred to at the bottom in the captions of 19th century fashion plates. Every once in a while, you'll see a ticket pocket referred to in the context of women's suiting. Mm-hmm. And I think in particular, the one I'm thinking of off the top of my head, it was women attending an art exhibition. And there's some reference to their ticket pockets, which was in their suits. So
super fascinating.
Okay, back to children's wear here for a brief moment.
Say, what do you have for you, April?
Underwaist. Do you know what this was? I did not know. We've touched on children's wear previously. So I'm going to just preface this next entry, I guess I'm going to call it, as being children's wear. But do you know what an underwaist was in the past? Also known as a panty waist.
An underwaist or a panty waist? I'm assuming it's some sort of undergarment, possibly a like boxer type undergarment. I've been meaning to do a history of panties and underwear for a long time. So maybe this will finally inspire me.
Yes. So you are correct on the undergarment front. It was a child's typically cotton undergarment of the late 19th and early 20th century. But what's really interesting about this, and you would know more about this than I do, I think maybe with the invention of elastic and its prevalence now within kids' clothes, this is a moot point. But basically, it was a sleeveless button-down front top. Mm-hmm. And then around the waistline of said top were buttons. And those were meant to button to panties to hold them up with the diapers underneath. This garment is really interesting because now we're starting to eke in the 20th century into the invention of elastic. So sometimes this upper underwaist also had elastic garters or tabs to hold up the child's stockings as well.
This sounds incredibly complicated because if you have a little person like I do who's two and is just running around wild, I can't even imagine how you would get them to sit still long enough to do all of these things.
So it was a little undershirt that buttoned down the front. And then around the waist of the undershirt, it had additional buttons so that you could attach their panties to it. And maybe it also had elastic garters or stockings to hold up their hose. Seems like a lot.
Fascinating and surely short-lived because now, of course, the snaps are all at the crotch area, right? Because that's the easiest way to get in and out of a diaper. But yeah. That's super fascinating. You had hinted at possibly doing a children's wear episode in the future because there are so many fascinating, again, material culture, the material culture of getting dressed, fascinating for adults and fascinating for children as well.
Yes, I definitely have a children's wear episode coming up and I'll just tease it a smidge. Let's just say it's going to be called Bump Proof the Baby.
Can't wait.
What do you have next?
V is for Victorine. Do you know what a Victorine is?
Gosh, I feel like I should, but I do not. Something maybe is rolling around in the back of my brain that it maybe has something to do with a yoke style of a woman's dress.
You're not far off, not entirely, but you're close. So I'll give you a hint. It's named after a very famous fashion influencer and royal of the 19th century, who spurred more than one fashion trend bearing her name, including this particular item, which is defined thanks to a Harper's Bazaar article I found on the Follies of Fashion from 1884, which I actually might do a podcast episode on this Follies of Fashion. It's a regular column in Harper's Bazaar, and this particular one derides fashion as the, quote, tyrant of fops and females, before giving us a historic survey of fashion's most notable offenses, which included various 18th century fashion and beauty devices, including hoops, panniers, the use of lemon by 18th century ladies to redden their lips. There's all kinds of really fascinating little anecdotes.
Them in their eyeball before they went into a ball, which is in etiquette books. Squeeze lemon juice in your eyes to make them sparkle before you go into the party.
And the author talks about how, quote, we've seen several examples of the influence possessed by the world's great ones in making a certain mode of dress, however absurd the prevailing fashion. For this reason, many articles of apparel have taken their names from noted persons. Thus, we have the Derby hat and scarf, the Byron collar, the Wellington boot, the Prince Albert coat, and it concludes with the Victorine, which of course is named after Queen Victoria.
Can I put another guess forward?
Sure.
At this point? Okay. Is it a shawl of some type?
Yes, it's a peculiar, as Harper's Bazaar describes, a peculiar fur cape named after Queen Victoria. But what's fascinating is, because you know how we love getting into the ProQuest search in these archives, there's various incarnations of it beginning in the 1850s. So the one illustrated version I found was actually from 1894. So a short shoulder cape that had tabards that extended almost to the floor. And this particular one, it is fur sealskin with an edging of chinchillas. So apparently it is a fur cape inspired by Queen Victoria with a very long range of popularity, paralleling the life of Queen Victoria, who did not die until 1901. Very fascinating.
Speaking of the 19th century, do you know what weepers were?
Weepers? I sadly do not.
Well, you would be correct in this inclination that they might have something to do with the culture of mourning, aka bereavement, because weepers were muslin armbands or sometimes hat bands that were worn by mourners in both the 18th and 19th century to indicate that you were in a period of bereavement for someone. Also, of course, during these time periods, sometimes people would, their entire wardrobe would transition into the colors of mourning, depending on what phase of mourning that they were in, depending on how close they were to the individual. If it was a close family member, obviously you would probably be wearing all black and then transition into gray and white and perhaps purple lilac shades in later phases of mourning. But if somebody was a distant relative or maybe even a public figure and you wanted to indicate your bereavement in their passing, you might wear a weeper. Just saying.
Fascinating.
Yeah, almost always, they were almost always black in color, but there was a weird caveat that if it was a young girl that was the deceased, you would wear white.
That's super interesting. And again, something that doesn't necessarily survive in our culture today, but was certainly prevalent even into the 20th century, as I'm thinking in terms of the black armbands. So super fascinating. I had not heard of weepers.
I think that whole kind of culture died out in World War One, and there's even magazine articles in the fashion magazines. People were still wearing the colors of mourning during World War One, but also there were entire articles written about how that practice was starting to die out because there had been so much death and destruction in the 19-teens that when people were recovering from that time period, they didn't want to see it everywhere in front of them. So that's part of the reason why that died out as a practice a bit.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
Not to end that on a maudlin note, but what's next? Let's move on.
X is really hard, was very hard, especially within the English language. There's a lot of Chinese words that begin with X, is what I found. And certainly we could do additions for like different cultures because there's so many different words. So fascinating. But so X, English language, very limited to what I could pick. But have you heard of X-ray beauty contests?
I have not. And I am bated breath over here.
Was totally a thing. Beauty contest culture really starting in, I think, the late teens and early 20s. We talk about this in our two-part swimsuit episode, grew out of boardwalk towns or coastal towns in America wanting to bring tourists in for beauty contests, right?
Look at the pretty ladies.
They used women and women's bodies and the judging of women's bodies to bring tourists obviously grew into a multi-billion dollar industry that we still are grappling with today. And so chiropractors actually took hold of the beauty contest event. And this is something I read about in an NPR article by Scott Hensley about the history of x-ray beauty contests, which began in the 1920s, so when really beauty contest culture takes off, but apparently became all the rage in the 50s and 60s, when he talks about how contestants were typically judged on beauty and poise, posture, and then they used x-rays to evaluate their spinal structure.
That seems like a little bit of quack science infused into a beauty contest over here. I'm not saying that x-rays or chiropractic is quack science, but I'm just imagining someone being like, how can I promote my chiropractic business?
That's exactly what it was.
By way of this beauty contest.
Yes, it was a marketing scheme for sure. And a brilliant one at that, because they were very popular. They maybe didn't know as much as they do now about radiation and exposing people to x-rays. The article features an interview with Dr. Reginald Hugg, who is a chiropractor. And he's talking about how basically chiropractic had a PR problem. Because in this period in the mid-20th century, they weren't licensed. They weren't necessarily a respected profession in terms of medicine. They were really needing to justify and validate what they do. And he talks about how this was a great way to get PR that was kind of middle of the road, he says. That was that good posture leads to good health, and chiropractors were the people to get you on the right path. And then the article goes on to explain that by, quote, crowning posture queens, the chiropractors could build goodwill without making waves with traditional doctors. So isn't that fascinating? And also just put it within the larger, longer history of beauty culture and using women's bodies to promote various aspects of various professions, et cetera. It's just fascinating.
More products.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've done that episode on the DeBerry beauty course in the past, and so much of that was about posture. So much of that 1930s, 1940s, 1950s discourse about physical health and exercise around women had a lot to do with posture. Not so much in like building muscle or working out, but posture was a huge topic of conversation.
So there you have it.
Cass? Did you know that learning a new language isn't only helpful for international travel? Acquiring new language skills also has cognitive benefits and can improve brain function. Studies have shown that learning a new language can improve memory, problem-solving skills, and even delay the onset of dementia.
There are so many reasons to learn a new language, trust listeners, and Rosetta Stone has been the trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. Available to use on a desktop or an app, Rosetta Stone is flexible for when you want to learn fast by immersion.
With features like True Accent that gives you feedback on your pronunciation, to the fact that you get lifetime access to all of Rosetta Stone's 25 languages, this incredible offer solves all your language learning needs for life.
Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Trust listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today. Dress listeners, it goes without saying that a lot of our shopping errands are made easier these days by shopping online. So why aren't you using Rakuten? Rakuten is the smartest way to save money when you shop.
That's right. You can earn cash back when you shop at 3,500 stores for fashion, beauty, electronics, home essentials, travel, dining, concert tickets, and more. How does it work, you ask? Well, brands pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and this is passed along to you as cash back.
From Sephora to Petco and Levi's to Expedia, when you shop with Rakuten, your cash back can be deposited directly into your PayPal account, or they will send you a check. Membership is free, and you can even maximize your savings by stacking cash back on top of other deals like store sales and coupons.
If you're already shopping at your favorite stores, why not save while you're doing it? Get the Rakuten app now and join the 17 million users who are already saving. Cashback rates change daily. See Rakuten.com for details. That's Rakuten. Your cashback really adds up. Menopause, perimenopause, these can be some of the most uncomfortable phases of a woman's life. If you find yourself in either of these, well, Hormone Harmony is here for you. Hormone Harmony capsules contain science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life.
Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it really shows.
And get this, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it is perfect for those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold.
And for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DRESSED at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DRESSED for 15% off today.
I'm approaching my last entry. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, because this garment is going to come at you, not over you. Just saying. Do you know what a York wrapper was?
A York wrapper.
W-R-A-P-P-E-R.
Yes, so a wrapper, popular mid-19th century woman's garment worn at home.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. A York makes me think of England. If it's coming at you, that is where I have no idea where you're going with this.
Exactly. I would say you get a point for this because wrappers were definitely this sort of very informal. Maybe you would wear it in the morning. Your friends were going to come over and have coffee or tea in the morning at home, informal garment. But people can see it, but maybe not more formal friends, just very super those intimate in your life, your friends and your family, closest friends and family. But a York wrapper in particular was back buttoned, which is very interesting. So it was a back buttoned, high-necked woman's morning, aka in the early time of day, dress of muslin. So you would essentially enter it with your arms out and it would go over you, and then your lady's maid would button it up the back.
Interesting. There you go.
So it's a very particular form of mourning dress.
Not
elite, obviously.
Weeping mourning, but daytime mourning.
Yes.
And we are ending with the letter Z. And April, dress listeners, did you know that zebras have feathers? Neither did
I. Zebras have feathers.
Yes, zebra feathers is my last term.
I need to know all about this.
Zebra feathers are feathers that have been painted or dyed in two colors. And it's you can find it as early as 1816 in fashion. Obviously, zebras famously have stripes, two colors, black and white. And so they gave their name to feathers that were artificially painted or dyed to do the same.
So wait, zebras don't actually have feathers.
No, zebras do not actually have feathers.
But zebras... Okay, so in the 1780s, maybe even the 1770s, I can't remember, but there was a zoo at Versailles, and some diplomatic gift was given to Louis XV of a zebra, and in the 1780s, it spawned this entire trend and fad in menswear for zebra-striped everything, and we actually have fashion plates in Galerie des Modes of zebra-striped stockings for men. So they were wearing their little knee breeches, and of course they're wearing stockings underneath, but some of them were zebra-striped, and we have representations of it in fashion plates.
Super fascinating.
Freaking cool. Yeah. And it's all due to the one zebra who was a diplomatic gift to the king in the Versailles Zoo.
Yeah, that's so fascinating.
On that note... An hour in, we've brought you an entire new lexicon of fashion.
We've done it. We have reached the end of the alphabet. I hope you have had as much fun as we have getting here.
And we hope that you have enjoyed our kind of, I don't know, I guess this is a second reinvention of this same theme of episode cast where we investigate fashion history terms from the past from A to Z. If you like this episode and you would like us to do a third installment, please just let us know.
Yes, we've had so much fun today going through history and through all of these different archives and texts to find these words for you. So if you have any that you want us to investigate further as well, any bizarre fashion industry terms or trends, send them our way. We always love hearing from you.
In the meantime, please just remember that fashion is a language next time you get dressed. Remember, we love hearing from you. So if you'd like to write to us, you can do so at hello@dressedhistory.com, or you can also DM us on Instagram @dressed_podcast, which is, of course, where you'll find reels and posts accompanying each week's episodes. If you'd like to find content for this week's episodes, which is going to be a two-parter, that can be found at #dress508 and #dress509. We get so many questions from you all about our recommendations for fashion history books. So if you're interested, you can always find a link in our show notes to our bookshop bookshelf. So that address is bookshop.org/shop/dressed. And there you can find over 150 of our favorite fashion history titles.
You can also find a link to that in our show notes, where you can find a link to dressedhistory.com, which of course is our website, where you can check out our latest offerings from the Dressed universe. That includes our classes and our tours. So head on over to dressedhistory.com and see what we have up our sleeves.
Also, you can find out more information about my Fashion History Fridays at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. There you can join me for a 90-minute tour of the Met's most fashionable masterpieces, starting in the ancient world all the way into the 20th century. And just teeny little heads up, friends, my Met tours in NYC are going to be on pause until late November. You can pick me up late November and into 2025. In the intervening weeks, I'll be in Paris, and I might just have some Parisian things up my sleeve there as well. But I'll keep you all posted.
Love Dress but want to skip the ads? Consider subscribing to our ad-free version of the show for just $3 a month and enjoy our 8 new episodes a month ad-free. That does it for us today, Dress listeners. Thank you as always for tuning in, and more Dress coming your way very soon. Dress, the History of Fashion is a production of Dressed Media.
During the summer, I love to keep Fiji water on hand to keep me and my family hydrated and refreshed. It really is sourced from the islands of Fiji. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable ancient aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements. As the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium water bottle brands, giving Fiji water its soft, smooth taste. Unlike some other premium bottled waters, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring, and this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water, and since 2022, its 330-milliliter and 500-milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic, so you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water. Get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office. It's not just water, it's Fiji water.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.